thought I would address three different issues. One is a ha'ara that my father, Rav Shalom, was very fond of in the Parsha, in Pekudei. I mean, I'll just start with that, because it's something which is, if you have a chumash there, it would be helpful. There are a few chumashim here, so perhaps you could just look at the one or two chumashim here. In the Perek Lam, it says, Sukkim Mem Beis and Mem Gimel. As you know, in Parshas Pekudei, essentially what you have in both Vayakal Pekudei, you have a implementation of that which is mentioned earlier in Truma Tetzava. Correct? Truma is the Parsha, as you know, of the Klei HaMishkan. The Moshe Rabbeinu was told to construct the Klei HaMishkan. Tetzava is Bigdei Kehuna. Thank you very much. And then we have here in Vayakal Pekudei an implementation of that which is found earlier in Truma Tetzava. So one of the psukim that is very troubling, which is found at the end of the construction of the Mishkan, is the following pasuk. Take a look at Perek Lamites, Psukim Mem Beis and Mem Gimel. The pasuk says, "V'chol asher tziva Hashem es Moshe, kein asu b'nei Yisrael es kol ha'avodah." As Moshe Rabbeinu had been instructed by Hashem, Klal Yisrael carried out es kol ha'avodah. The word avodah. Next pasuk, Mem Gimel. Vayar Moshe es kol ha'milocha. These are two words that seemingly are clearly very similar. Avodah and Malacha. Vayar Moshe is called Malacha, v'nei asu asa, kasher tzivu Hashem, kein asu, v'yivarach asa Moshe. Why would the Torah decide to use two different terms to describe what seems to be essentially the identical idea? First it mentions the Pasuk Mem Beis, just as Hashem instructed Moshe, Klal Yisrael carried out the Avodah. And then the second Pasuk uses a different term, Vayar Moshe es kol ha'melacha v'hinei asu asa kasher tzivu Hashem kein asu v'yivarach asa Moshe. And secondly, why the Arichus? Both psukim are saying exactly the same thing. Namely, that Klal Yisrael carried out the Dvar Hashem, they carried out the Tzivu Hashem. So I'm asking two questions. Question one, the two different terms that are used here, one avoda and one melacha. And secondly, why the repetition? So if I were to ask you, what is the distinction between these two terms? I'm asking in, you just said you are proficient in English. So perhaps you also have, suspect you have a proficiency in Hebrew as well. And you're just being modest about it. So what's the distinction between these two terms? How do you define the term avoda? And how do you define the term melacha? So my father thought that the term avoda somehow, thank you very much. It's not necessary to bring so many as I told you, but okay. I appreciate it. My father thought that the term avoda is miloshen eved. Avoda has something to do with eved. Eved is a servant. And the word melacha, my father thought, is related to the word melech, or from the loshen of nimlach v'daito. So, to give you an example, if a king issues an order, issues a directive that a wall should be built, or if a president issues a directive that a wall should be built, separating one country from another in order to prevent illegal aliens from entering, from crossing the border. So what exactly is his intention? His intention is that he plans on the president, the fake newsman, does he plan on actually schlepping all the stones and literally doing the actual building, doing the actual construction? Is that his intention? Certainly not. He's not going to be schlepping anything. He will sit b'sheket al-kisei malchuso over there in a large oval room in the White House, and obviously he will consult his courtiers and advisors. So which one would you say is considered to be the individual who came up, which term would be used to describe the individual who has the machshavah to go ahead and do it? And which term actually refers to the building of it? Let's start. Which is the machshavah term, the one that describes the machshavah that's behind what's about to be done? And which term describes the actual work and the effort that goes into it? And the answer is? The term malacha refers to what?
The work.
That's the opposite. The term malacha refers to the machshavah, to the essential idea that is clearly behind this entire project. And the avoda, of course, is the actual labor and the putting together whatever materials are required, are necessary in order to carry this out. Just to give you another example that would prove this point, you're familiar with Hilchos Shabbos, all of you, and you know there's a cloud when it comes to Hilchos Shabbos that in order that somebody should be chayiv for one of the Mamzes Melachos, so the Gemara uses an expression. Excellent. Melachos Machshavos Osva Torah. You just redeemed yourself, Baruch Hashem, in a very beautiful way. So Melachos Machshavos Osva Torah. So now, this is apparently what the Pasuk is saying. The Torah says, Pasuk Membeis, Kechol Asher Tzivu Hashem Es Moshe, Kein Osu B'nei Yisrael Es Kol HaAvoda. They saw literally the Avoda that was done. I'm talking about the Kroshim, the Urios, the Aron, the Shulchan, all the Pratim, the Pifte Pratim, all the particular elements that constituted the Mishkan. And then, subsequently, Vayar Moshe Es Kol HaMalacha. Once everything is in place, what does Moshe see? The overall plan. Moshe sees the overall scheme of things, because obviously when the individual pre-tim are not yet in place, you don't really have a good sense of the entire artisanship. But now that you see the entire Mishkan in place, all the building blocks are now put together, so now you see the Malacha, which is the Mashava that accompanied this entire project. A Mashava, which of course is only Moshe Rabbeinu could see, and that's what the Pasuk says. Vayar Moshe es kol ha-malacha b'nei osu osu kasher tzivu Hashem kein osu vayivar chosu Moshe. This is obviously a very significant distinction between these two terms. And as I said, the Gemara says in Beitza, the Gemara points out that Melachos Machshavos Osu HaTorah. Melachos Machshavos Osu HaTorah means that in order to be chayiv Hilchos Shabbos, as you know, what is the ikar of Melachos Machshavos? So that happens to be the subject of probably a lot of discussion, but I'm not going to go into that right now. But simply just to, by way of the introduction to this year, just to mention this distinction between the two terms, which I think are very critical. Now I'll just say one more thing, and this also will be the enhancing of this, what I just said now. There's a Rashi, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. Those who are careful, there actually are some wonderful young people in front of me, who are very, very makbid, how they learn the Rashi. And they learn the Rashi really with, I'm quite impressed how they study Rashi and study it quite carefully. And this Rashi actually is found a number of times in Medrash. There was a machlokes apparently between Bezalel and Moshe Rabbeinu. I want to read to you a Rashi at the beginning of the Parsha. Rashi, if you have the Chumash in front of you, you can see it. Rashi is found in Perek Lameches, Pasuk Chavbeis. But the Torah mentions who were the ones who were responsible for the architecture of the building of the Mishkan, Bezalel and Eliyahu. You recall them? So Rashi said the following, that Moshe Tzivah the Bezalel, Lasso Tzchila Kelim, Yachakach Mishkan. Moshe Rabbeinu, what did he tell Bezalel? What was the order that he directed him to do? First make the Kelim, and then build the Mishkan. Rashi actually is very marach over here. Hashem, what did he indicate in Parshas Truma? First, Hashem said, Kelim, Shulchan, Menorah, Yerios, Tzivi HaKoshin. And if you look at the beginning of Vayakel, Rashi says that there it says, Tchilas HaMishkan, and then the Kelim. Now, there seems to be a discrepancy between Moshe Rabbeinu, what he had in mind, and what Bezalel had in mind. Bezalel really completely changed the position of Moshe Rabbeinu. And I'll read the end of Rashi. Amar lo Bezalel, Minhaga olam la'asot tchila bayis, yachakach meisim kelim betocho. What are you telling me to build the kelim, construct the particular items of the Mishkan, and then subsequently build the Mishkan? If you go and purchase furniture, you don't purchase furniture unless you first have a house to put the furniture in. And here we're told the reverse. Namely, Bezalel said, Minhaga olam is first to have a purchase a home, and now you have a place to put the furniture in. So Amala Moshe Rabbeinu said, Kach shamati b'Kadosh Baruch Hu, Amar Moshe, Bezalel kel ha'isa, ki vali kach tzivu l'Kadosh Baruch Hu, v'chein osa ha'mishkan tchila, v'achal kach osa kelim. So the question, what's the machlokes between Bezalel and Moshe Rabbeinu regarding what should be done first? First the kelim, and then the Mishkan? Or first the Mishkan, and then the kelim? So I heard from Rabbeim that the machlokes is the following. And this is a very fundamental machlokes, a very basic two perspectives when you ever are going to go ahead and build something, construct something. Bezalel is an architect. And he's an architect who primarily is really in the construction business. Maybe he's less of an architect than someone in the construction business. Someone in the construction business is concerned about the particulars of how they were going to put together this project. And the project, the whole consists of the sum of its parts. So we have all types of kelim, as I mentioned a moment ago, krushim and urios and menorah and mizbechos, different types of mizbechos, outside, inside, and the like. So he's concerned about every prat. He's concerned about every particular element. But Moshe Rabbeinu has a different perspective. His perspective is more the overall design, the overall scheme of things, the overall artistry that emerges. Because when a person looks at a home, so when one looks on the architectural blueprint or design, it's not always easy to see, but usually what they do is an artist will also draw the ultimate home. That's what they do. They don't want you just to see the blueprint of the architect. That's not sufficient. That's not going to give you much insight into what it's going to look like. Because there are two aspects to every home. One, of course, are the contents, but perhaps in some respects, even more significantly, is the overall design, or the overall picture, or the overall feeling that one has when a person sees a home. I imagine you do have that concept. There are two different aspects. So he, Bezalel and Moshe Rabbeinu, apparently, had a machlokes. Bezalel is concerned about the particulars, about the individual items, because he's constructing, he's building each item. Moshe Rabbeinu is more concerned about the overall picture. And that's the machlokes between Bezalel and Moshe Rabbeinu regarding what comes first, the kelim, and then subsequently the mishkan. Well, no, first you need a home, and then once you have that home, then you can put the kelim inside. Okay, that's the item on just the ha'ara on the parsha that I think is of interest.
Who said mishkan first?
Rashi quotes. Take a look at the Rashi in Perek Lamaches, Pasuk Habez. Moshe told Bezalel to first make the kelim and then the mishkan, and Bezalel thought otherwise.
Why?
Exactly what I just said, because as Bezalel indicated that minigah olam lasot tchila bayis yachakach meisim kelim betochol. First you build the home and then you have a place to put all these kelim in. First I build the home and then I have furniture that I put inside. So Bezalel, in effect, said, this is what I heard. Moshe said, apparently you were in the shadow of Hashem. Bezalel, Bezalel Kel, in the shadow of Hashem. Kivare tzivali HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He agreed that this your position is correct. V'chein osa mishkan tchila, v'achag osa kelim. I don't know if you've ever gone looking for homes. Perhaps that's not what you've done yet in your life. I mean, you might eventually come to do that. There's no question that most people would take that approach. They would like to see the home from an overall perspective. And then, obviously, in terms of what kind of furniture they're going to put in, that will come secondarily, as opposed to the initial kind of approach. Okay, the second point I wanted to essentially talk about was another very important yesod, which is the medrash at the beginning of Pekudei, that what is going on at the beginning of Pekudei, there's an accounting that's taking place on the part of Moshe Rabbeinu. Eila Pekudei HaMishkan, Mishkan HaEdos, Asher Pukar HaPi Moshe, Avon HaSalvim, V'yad Yisomah, V'naran HaKoyim. And Moshe Rabbeinu is taking an accounting, and this accounting is very, very critical. I'll read a medrash, that the medrash, I wrote it down for myself. The medrash says that once the Mishkan was built, so Moshe Rabbeinu started making a cheshbon. He literally went to, because a lot of gold and silver was donated by Kol Yisrael. Enormous sums of money were donated. It's amazing how they gave literally massive sums of money. And then apparently there was some discrepancy. I don't know if you're aware of what's going on in this country right now. There are elections about to take place in about another month or so. The Prime Minister, Netanyahu, has been not yet, even though he's obviously not proven guilty, till there's a hearing and a court and all the like, but he's now under accusation of engaging in all kinds of skullduggery. I'm not going to go into all the details. People who bribed him with champagne and cigars to the tune of, I don't know, Daniel, how much was it worth? That's what they claim. How much champagne could a person drink? How many cigars could a person smoke? Politicians, as you know, they are involved in such matters because the nature of being a politician is such that you people want favors from you. You're in a position of power, and therefore they simply provide you with a few presents here and there in order to help you make the right decision and the like. So that's what he's been accused of, bribery and laundering and all kinds of other types of things. And this is not unusual. I don't get excited about champagne and cigars. But the notion is that he was, as a result, attempting to influence large newspapers, very, very significant and very highly touted newspapers here in the country, that they would obviously write in his favor, and all kinds of things of that sort. And what else is new? Anyway, so Moshe Rabbeinu is accused of, there's a discrepancy that takes place, and Hashem comes to him, and Hashem shows him that the discrepancy was in the Vavim La'amudim, in the hooks that were for the pillars in the Mishkan, and therefore everything was, Baruch Hashem, accounted for. So the Chazal here have an unbelievable discussion about the following issue, which was an issue of a leader who can easily be accused of this kind of monetary embezzlement and the like, and putting money in his own pocket, which is the case in many countries in the world, especially communist countries, that you see quite often. They became quite wealthy. Many, many years ago, there was a woman who was the Prime Minister of the Philippines. Her name was Marcos, Imelda Marcos. And they discovered, after she was investigated for all kinds of things of this sort, that she had 1,000 pair of shoes. Even a woman does not require 1,000 pair of shoes. I think there are only 365 days in the year. Assuming you have one for every day, maybe you need one for Shacharis, one for Mincha. I don't exactly know what the requirements are. But at the end of the day, they discovered she had embezzled millions and millions of dollars from the Philippines, which is generally one of the reasons why people like to become leaders in countries. So they use such an opportunity. That's something which is so foreign to a Torah personality. And obviously, Moshe Rabbeinu is the ideal Torah personality. So here, the Medrash asks, why did Moshe Rabbeinu have to make a cheshvan? Why do you have to go make an accounting? Why do you have to call an accounting firm in order to take care, to oversee that all the expenditures and all the money that was donated was directed properly? Doesn't Hashem trust Moshe Rabbeinu? The whole Beisi Nemanu, he's completely credible, completely trustworthy. Shelo Yomru, so no one should say, Adam Sheshalat Amalekas HaMishkan, that this guy, he was in charge of the Melechas HaMishkan, and he what? He became wealthy as a result of Melechas HaMishkan. He, shall we say, put money in his own pocket. A lot of money, as leaders are wont to do. His Moshe Rabbeinu became wealthy. And there's a Mishnah in Shkolin, in Masechet Shkolin, that the Mishnah says that when people used to come to give money to the Karbanos, what's called the Tumas HaLishka, you're learning Mishnayos, so maybe you passed those Mishnayos in Shkolin a long time ago. You're learning about Basra already. You finish Maya, you finish Noshim, you're holding the Zikin. What was that?
I didn't start back then.
Okay, but it doesn't make a difference. Anyway, so the Tumas HaLishka, the Mishnah writes over there in Masechet Shavuos, in Masechet Shkolin, because it talks about when they used to give for the Karbanos, and the Mishnah speaks about how careful you have to be when you go ahead and you go into the area where you're going to give the money. It says, Ein HaTorah Nichnas, the person who gives the money, he's not allowed to enter. Lo Bipargut, he can't enter with a beggar that has seams, that has large pockets. Below Bimanulim, below Bisandalim, he can't go with his shoes in there. Below Bitfilin, below Bikmeya, he can't go with his tefillin. He can't go with Kmeyas. And it goes on and on. Why? Because we're afraid that maybe he will smuggle some of the money and in his pocket, take it out of the Tumas HaLishka, or whatever he might do. And Ad Kedekach, I don't know if you remember, many, many years ago, there was a story about a chassid who smuggled diamonds in his tefillin. He smuggled diamonds into the country, to the United States, and they caught him. And you can imagine the tefillin of Hashem was Oyem Menorah, was beyond belief. This is not an uncommon thing. So here the Mishnah tells you how careful that the person has to be. Shema Yeyashir, maybe he become wealthy. Or Shema Yeyani, maybe he becomes very poor. And the reason why he became very poor, because he took money from the Tumas HaLishka, and on and on and on. And the Mishnah says, why is that so? Why do we have to be concerned about it? So the Mishnah said, Sh'adam tzarech latzitz yedei abrios, k'dam sh'tzarech latzitz yedei abokom. Because you have to be completely clean, completely free of any chshad, How do you translate kshad? Someone might accuse you of this kind of skullduggery. Someone might be chashid you. Shenema v'yisem v'kiyem yashem v'yisrael. The Mishnah calls two psukim. One pasuk says v'yisem v'kiyem yashem v'yisrael, and the other pasuk says u'mitzachin v'seif al tov ben yelokim v'adam. You have to be exceptionally careful, and those who know that Gedolei Yisrael were unbelievably, incredibly honest. Their honesty was so impeccable and so mind-boggling. Rabbi Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, Moreinu Rabbeinu, Maran HaRav, Gedol HaDor, the one who saved the North American rabbinate and the South American rabbinate and all the rabbinates, and the one who salvaged Judaism at a time when it was somewhat rickety, somewhat shaky. So Rabbi Soloveitchik was, when he came to the United States, he came to Boston, became the Rabbi Kollel of Boston, the chief rabbi of Boston, at a very young age. At that time, there were shochtim, the shochtim union, the slaughterers, the people who were involved in Shechita. It was a real mafioso operation. Total mafia from beginning to end. They controlled the entire shochtim union. And they were terrorists. Terrorists from every standpoint. They were people who were swindlers. They were thieves. They were ganavim, engaged in every kind of chicanery imaginable. This is already written up, all this. And he had to go against them and try to put the place in order. So they decided, this guy, this upstart, is a troublemaker. It could be it's in that movie. I don't recall that particular element. You saw the movie, obviously. Okay, I saw it about five times. But somehow I don't remember that element. I told you my opinion, my position on the movie already. I said a number of times. But anyway, I sat on five panels regarding that movie. First they showed the movie, and there was a panel. So each time with different people. So I expressed my opinion a number of times, including with him, the Rav Akiva Shlita. Anyway, so they accused him of all kinds of things, and then they decided they got to get him. So how did they get him? They accused him of cheating the United States government, cheating the IRS, swindling the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, not paying his taxes, and he was trying to hide money and launder money, all kinds of things, and the IRS went after him. He was a very young man at that time. I think he was maybe in his early 30s. Not even sure he was that, maybe in his late 20s. And they went after him. And this investigation went on for a number of years. And at the end, it turned out that not only did Rabbi Soloveitchik not swindle the IRS, he overpaid on his taxes, way over what he should have paid. This came out from accounting reports, and it's interesting. He didn't become the Rosh Hashiva of Yisrael Chanan, otherwise known as Yeshiva University, because he was under a cloud of suspicion for all this investigation was going on. And once he was cleared, it was unbelievable that it was the biggest Kiddush Hashem imaginable. This well-known Orthodox rabbi was really well-known as a young man, and how honest he was, impeccably honest. I remember he told us that sometimes he described scenes that take place, I guess today it's quite overt, namely people go into Manhattan, and all of a sudden you see someone. Often I wait in Manhattan from time to time, all of a sudden you see people set up tables and they're selling Rolex watches. Are you familiar with that phenomenon? Perhaps you've never seen it. I've seen it now four or five times in my life in different parts of Manhattan. And then before you know it, a few moments later, sometimes a police car, dispatch car appears in the scene. All of a sudden the table is folded up in about 3.5 seconds. And then he's gone and they disappear. I've seen that four or five times in my life. So once I was curious to see how much a Rolex watch, which is a rather expensive kind of deal, what does it cost? It was selling it for $15. So first I wasn't sure. I asked someone on the street, is this a real Rolex watch? So they look at it, they said it is. He said, but obviously that guy is engaged in what they call thievery. Selling a Rolex watch, how much does it cost a Rolex watch, an authentic one, the real price?
$10,000.
They say several thousand dollars. He's selling it for $15. Incredible. What goes on in the world? So as I said, it's usher to buy from such people. What was he worried about? They don't pay taxes. That's what he was worried about. It's a problem in general. I'm not going to get to the halachic aspect of this right now because it needs a lot of discussion. Often people pay COD, cash on delivery. If you pay with a credit card, so they have to pay taxes. Of course, the onus is on whom? Not on you. It's on them. The mocher. How do you translate the mocher? The seller. The one who sells the goods without paying taxes, that's usa. There's a concept called dina machus dina. Anyway, the Torah here is very concerned about this issue. And there's a Chassam Sofer that I saw many, many years ago. He writes, Kol yomai ha'isi mistar al mikrozeh. My whole life I'm worried about one pasuk, namely, being honest. V'yisem nikiyim, that I should be honest, mi'ashem u'mi'yisem, in the eyes of God and the eyes of the Jewish people. And he says, v'yoser efshel latzik de'shamayim, mi'latzik de'abriyos. It's much easier to be a God-fearing Jew in terms of what? In terms of the mitzvahs that we do, as opposed to being a God-fearing Jew in terms of interacting with people in an honest kind of way. Often you see people who seem to be dressed in a very religious kind of way. I won't go into details. And they could literally take you for all you're worth. Cheat you and swindle you. And I'm not speaking about any specific ethnic group or religious group, but people with kippot and people with all kinds of other headgear and other types of clothing, which indicates a certain kind of approach or perspective or ideology, whatever you want to call it, and you can be cheated blindly. And that's something, of course, which is Ein Chachil Hashem Golem Mizeh. So here we have, in this parsha, a lot of discussion in Medrash. I saw an enormous amount of discussion in Midrashim about how one has to be exceptionally careful with reference to monetary matters, and to a large extent, an Orthodox Jew is going to be judged by his behavior in the monetary realm. In the economic realm, how honest he is, how literally, how careful he is. I'll just tell you a story. I saw this also many years ago by Rabbi Saul Salanta, the founder of the Muslim movement, the famous personality, that once he was a guest with a wealthy man, and he was talking to this wealthy person, and on the table there was a large sack of money. And at that point, someone in the family wanted to speak to this wealthy person. And so he came into the room, and he quickly, the wealthy man left to speak to his member of his family. And that moment that he left, Rabbi Saul Salanta ran out of the room like a fire. So afterwards, the wealthy man went looking for him, couldn't find him, he found him outside the house. He said, why did you have to go outside the house? It was freezing cold. Why did you leave? I left you there, I just went to talk to my family, my mishpacha, for a few moments. Why did you run out of the house? And he answered the following answer. Just like there's an Issa of Yichud with Arayos, there's an Issa of Yichud with money that is not yours. You hear that? Issa of Yichud! What's Yichud? You're not allowed to be with a woman on your own without the proper Shmira and the like. Unbelievable. And the Gemara says, this is what he quoted, Rabbi Saul Salant, Ruba Migezel. Most people are over on Gezel. One form of fascia. I told you there's a din of Shulchan Aruch that people are not so medaktik on. You see a pen on the table, it belongs to somebody, you take it, you use it just to write your name, or write something else. What's the problem? Is there a problem doing that, Al Pi Halacha? According to the Shulchan Aruch, there may be a problem. Or for that matter, even taking a sefer that belongs to someone. Although it could be that today people are not so makbid, not on pens, not on svarim, not on anything for that matter. But Rabbi Saul Salanta was concerned about the chashash of Yisrael Nikiyam, Hashem of Yisrael. Amazing. That the honesty of Gedol Yisrael, which is really, to a large extent, I would say, very much reflects where they're coming from and what they're all about. That was the second element I wanted to talk about today. And now the third element is, this week is the yard site of our Gaon of Yaakov Kamenetsky Zatzal. Lately I've been talking about Gedol Yisrael. I decided to familiarize you with a few more, if you don't mind. His yard site is the end of the week, and I think it's third yard site. I was zoche to hear of Yaakov Kamenetsky a number of times in my lifetime. I used to go to Torah Masorah conventions, and he used to speak on Tanakh. He knew the entire Tanakh by heart. Shas, obviously, he knew by heart. But he knew Tanakh by heart. Now, he always speak on Tanakh. So there are a number of just vignettes that I'm aware of that I'll share with you. I think I mentioned that in 1983, I went to speak to Rabbi Nachman Kamenetsky. I already told this story, but I'm just going to, by way of introduction, tell it again. I went to speak to him because at that time I was in the world of chinuch and the rabbinate, and I decided maybe chinuch is not for me. Maybe I should leave that profession and enter another profession. So my rabbi, Rabbi Yisum Alpatzatzal, told me that I shouldn't. And he said he's going to send me to one of the Gdolei Yisrael too, I could discuss it with. So I thought he would send me to his rebbe, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein Zatzal. He didn't. He sent me, he called up Rabbi Akiva Kamenetsky and arranged an appointment with me in Muncie in the house of Rabbi Akiva Kamenetsky. Until the end of his life, he was 93 years old when I saw him. But he was completely, totally with it. Totally. Just frail, but completely with it. And so I went there, and after back and forth, Rabbi Akiva Kamenetsky, he decided I should remain in chinuch, and he told me, now should I remain in chinuch, but he had a job for me. Where? In the city of Toronto. So I was astounded. I never heard of Toronto. I mean, I heard the name of the city. But I'm a New Yorker. U.S., born and bred. And I thought that Canada was perhaps an extension of the U.S. The 51st state, something like that. He then proceeds to call up several Balabatim in Toronto, and in Yiddish he speaks to them, and before I knew it, I am traveling to Toronto for an interview. I was not even consulted. He thought I was the perfect person for that particular position. And a little while later, I became the Rosh Hashiva of the Bnei Akiva Yeshiva in Toronto, and also became a Rav in Toronto, in a shul for 10 years I lived in the city of Toronto, and that actually enabled me, ultimately, I made Aliyah from Toronto. I came to Eretz Yisrael. There were a lot of people there who were connected to Eretz Yisrael, and really, I credit him, I go to Jack Kamenetsky, I give him a lot of Hakar Sato for helping me come to Eretz Yisrael. Anyway, once I had Jack Kamenetsky in front of me, and my wife was with me, so I decided to ask him every single question that I have, and basically, Hakim Achainik. Bell on the door right in front of you. Who could resist? So I asked him many questions, but one question I shared already a number of times, and I'm very taken by what he told me. I taught in the course of years, I taught many years ago in Providence, Rhode Island. You probably never even heard of such a state. Are you aware that there's a state called Rhode Island?
Yes.
You are. Chaim, how are you aware of it? Have you been to Newport Synagogue?
The oldest shul.
The oldest shul. But that's not in Providence. Providence. I came to Providence. You want me to have something to drink? I came to Providence, which of course was very providential, as you can imagine. Anyway, so I arrived there on the scene, and it was like unbelievable after I left New York. And I was there a number of years in Providence. But I taught there a number of Iranian students. My first encounter with Iran. Today it's on the map in every shape, matter, and form, since they love us so dearly. The Iranians love the state of Israel, you're quite aware of it. Anyway, I teach Iranians, and I was very taken by them. Iranians who escaped when the Shah of Iran fell, when the government fell. So these Iranians escaped by themselves. They were young teenagers. Many of them escaped by themselves through the Carpathian Mountains in Turkey, what have you. Unbelievable stories they have. Many, many stories, very fascinating stories about their escape. And they came all over the place. They were in the United States. Today they're in a number of areas in Great Neck, New York. You're probably familiar. Great Neck is an area in New York City. Perhaps you're not aware of it. There's a state called California. There are Iranians there. Anyway, so make a long story short, I teach these Iranians. They are so refined. I was astounded. I've also taught in the course of my years in Chinuch, Russians who came out of Russia. They were the very antithesis of the Iranians. They were wild, undomesticated. Vilde chaya shein kamo. I don't know how to describe it. So I asked Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, how do you explain the disparity between the Iranians and the Russians? He was taken aback by the question. Taken aback completely. And he told me he's going to speak in Yiddish, and I understand Yiddish quite well. I grew up in Yiddish. And so I said, fine. So he tells me the following. First he asked me, do you know Jewish history? I wasn't sure to answer that question. What do you mean, do I know Jewish history? Did I study it formally? Did I study it carefully? I read. I'm a voracious reader, so I do read. Anyway, so I said, I have some familiarity. So he starts telling me about what happened in Russia in 1914. He goes through the entire Russian Revolution, literally, with great detail. I can't believe that such a gobble had such a knowledge of what went on over there. And he explains exactly that, obviously, once the Russians came into power, talking about the days of Stalin and Trotsky, all these wonderful, nice people, just being cute, and what they did to squelch Judaism completely, and we were completely cut off from anything having to do with Yiddishkeit and Judaism and Yadut. And as a result, Jews really, to a large extent, were severed from the Shulchan Aruch, from learning, and that began a period of almost 70 years where really it was black and bleak and darkness. And you probably know a little bit, I imagine, about what happened. There was a very famous Rav in Elizabeth, New Jersey, Rav Pinchas Teitz, Zag Livracha. That's your Mishpacha?
No.
You know about Elizabeth. So anyway, and his son also, Rav Elazar Meir Teitz, and there's a grandchildren today. Anyway, but the Rav Pinchas Teitz used to travel to Russia, and he traveled to Russia, he built mikvahs there, everything was done underground with the KGB following him around. There's a very good book, actually, that his daughter Rav Pinchas Teitz wrote, she is Rebbetzin, you probably know the Mashkiach in YU. There's a Mashkiach. There used to be a Mashpia in YU. Rav Moshe Weinberger, the one that you heard, the bleacher man, etc., etc. the one who's a rousing, captivating kind of fellow. He really is a beautiful person. And but there's a Mashkiach in YU, Rabbi Blau. Maybe anybody ever heard of him? So his wife is the daughter of Rav Pinchas Teitz. You know the family?
I know son.
Okay, which one?
Yeah.
Okay, they're beautiful children, tremendous children. Anyway, well, there are, by the way, one or two in Eretz Yisrael as well. Are you familiar?
familiar? I'm not.
Okay. There's in Cleveland, there's in Eretz Yisrael, there in Efrat, there are many different places, his children. Anyway, so his daughter wrote a beautiful book about her father, and there you see a description about what her father did in Russia. Okay, why I say all this, Rabbi Yaakov tells me, he's giving me this whole spiel about the Russian Jewry and what happened. And he said, as a result, they were completely severed from anything Jewish. No kosher food, no kashrus, no zero. Golnish mit golnish. That means nothing with nothing. And as a result, they had to eat trefa food and all the other unbelievable things that the KGB imposed upon them. And the Gemara says that you don't have kashrus, you have timtum halev. What's timtum halev? I'll call it spiritual atherosclerosis. Spiritual hardening of the arteries. I took biology, I hope you don't mind. Anyway, so you have this hardening of the arteries in a spiritual perspective, and as a result, you have Wildkeit, because the person, the Rambam, and the Rishonim write, you are what you eat, and that's why we eat kosher food, which is, I'm not going to get into the details of that now. Maybe you and I will have a conversation about this topic. A very fascinating conversation.
There's something about predatory
animals. Yes, that's Ramban. Ramban Chumash. It's also the Rambam of the Ruchim, and many Rishonim talk like that, namely, that the reason why the Torah has placed an interdiction on predatory animals because a person absorbs the attributes and qualities of predatory animals, becomes a predator himself, and develops achzorius cruelty. Anyway, that's how Yaakov Kamenetsky explained to me the Russian students that I had, and their Wildkeit, and they're unbelievable. And then I said, what about the Iranians? He said, even though the Shah fell, and it was difficult for Jews living in Iran. However, they still maintained their fealty to Kashrus and Shabbos and Taras and Mishpacha. And as a result of that, they are refined beyond belief. I'll never forget this. I came back. There were other questions I told them also, but I came back and I told this to my Rebbe, Rav Nissim Alper Zatzal. He told me, come with me right now to the Rosh Yeshiva and tell him what you heard from the, what he called, Chakima de Yudoi, the wisest man among the Jewish people. They consider Rabbi Kamenetsky to be the wisest man among the Jewish people. Anyone know the Kamenetsky family? Anybody have any connection with the Kamenetskys in the five towns?
Yes.
You have a connection? Yes. There's a Rabbi Mordechai Kamenetsky is the grandson of Rabbi Kamenetsky. South Shore? Anybody ever heard of South Shore Yeshiva?
Yeah.
Yes, so that's Rabbi Mordechai Kamenetsky, a grandson of Rabbi Kamenetsky. His father, Rabbi Yom Kamenetsky, was the son of Rabbi Yankiv. He founded the yeshiva, passed away, I think maybe 2 years ago in his 90s. They're all Zecha Tarich HaSyamim. My Rebbe, I had a Rebbe who wrote a book called The Making of a Gadol. Maybe you heard of it.
Yeah.
It's in a section in my house which is
closed off.
It was put in Cherem, that Sefer. Gorgeous, gorgeous Sefer. One of the best Svarim I had. Two volumes. It's supposed to be six volumes, but he can't write the rest because it affects the Shidduchim of his great grandchildren.
Rashid,
you
just reprinted it.
I'm sorry?
I just reprinted 50 copies.
You got a copy?
No, my friend did.
How much did it cost?
$150.
Wow, sure, it went down in price. They were selling it for on Amazon, eBay for $600, something like that. I happen to possess copies of it, because generally I happen to have copies of all the books that are in Cherem. Anyway, so I have a lot of interest in those things. It was put in Cherem because... From what I understand, because one of the stories that's told there, Rav Nosson Kamenetsky, Sheibadol Chaim Arukim, Hashem Shigim Arich HaSyamim, he's also one of the children of Yankin. He's a youngster, must be in his late 80s. Anyway, so he writes about the fact that his father, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, tells and told him apparently that Rav Aaron Kotler, you heard of Rav Aaron Kotler? Lakewood, there's like a yeshiva. Lakewood, I heard it's a relatively large yeshiva, they told me. Anyway, so maybe the largest yeshiva in the world. So the yeshiva Lakewood, Rav Aaron Kotler, had a sister who was a math professor. She tried to convince her brother to become a math professor. Rav Aaron Kotler, he was a genius. So was she. And he decided not to become a math professor, but rather to start the yeshiva Lakewood. And he's a son-in-law of Mrs. Alma Meltzer, one of the great Rosh Yeshiva from Kletsk, and later on Yerushalayim. And because of that, they put the sefer in Cherem. I don't grasp why the sefer was put in Cherem. He's telling us out, his whole theme is the following. You don't become a god of yourself overnight. You have to work, and you're challenged, and you also have Yetzirah. You don't think they don't need some Yetzirah? Of course they do. But they're able to overcome the Yetzirah. Just like Baruch Hashem, all of you are in the process of overcoming the Yetzirah. And you have probably larger Yetziraz in some respects, only because of what's going on out there. The world today is essentially maniacal. What? Very challenging. The world out there today is so overtly open in terms of all the, what Rabbi Olshin calls, all your toys, etc., and the like, all your machinery. And that, of course, can lead you astray. So it's very difficult. So, on the contrary, in some respects, you're on a higher madriga than these Gdolei Yisrael. Because you have to overcome much more. To make a long story short, they were not happy with the Sefer. They went into Cherem. Sure. And then it became, of course, the bestseller overnight, as usually. I always wanted my Sefer to be put in Cherem this way. And be sold, shall we say, more massively and more extensively. But my Sefer are too straight, too glatt. And I don't have any of that thing that is not acceptable, not available.
The
okay.
Drawer under the,
what was that?
The drawer that we saw on Friday night, like,
the drawer that you saw, which probably you shouldn't have opened up anyway, but the kids, sir, the drawer that you saw, which is, when I go to someone's home, I don't open up the
drawer. It wasn't me.
I didn't take it personally, just other people in my family did, but no,
it wasn't me.
It's fine, I'm not accusing you of anything.
I just saw these.
I have collections of Rabbi Cook, that's how I'm very into Rabbi Cook, but it's in one of my drawers. I also have another section, Chabad, where's Adnan? He's not here. Okay, Admon is absent without leave. Anyway, so the I have also on Chabad and Balatanya. I have all kinds of swarm in my house because I am open to everything, open to all. That's my nature. That's where I'm coming from. What can I do? Because I love all Gedolei Yisrael, different stripes, and I have no difficulty with that whatsoever. Probably because I'm a Talmud of Rav Soloveitchik, because I'm a Tzadik Mizrachi. Probably have that. Okay, what I wanted to talk about was about Kamenetsky. But I didn't get too far here. So I want to maybe just share one or two short little vignettes and just to give you a sense of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. Once Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, someone, another rabbi, was walking with him outside Torah Vadas. He was on Shiva Torah Vadas when he suddenly stopped and there were a whole bunch of guys playing handball. I don't know if you know what handball is. You do? Thank you. In the art of the yeshiva. And after Rabbi Yaakov stopped and watched them and then he continued walking and he sighed. So this rabbi was puzzled by Rabbi Yaakov's reaction. He said, what upset the Rosh Yeshiva? So he said the following. If he put as much effort into his learning as he did playing handball, he'd be a great Talmid Chacham. That's what he said to this rabbi. So this rabbi was so taken aback by this statement of Rabbi Yaakov. So he said, what should I do? So Rabbi Yaakov said, talk to him and tell him that he was impressed by his handball prowess. Avraham Kamenetsky, the Galador, impressed by this guy's handball abilities. And so what happened? This Rav spoke to this young man over the next few weeks, and he kept repeating Rav Yaakov's comment to the young man. And those few weeks proved to be a turning point in this guy's life. He started living with this Rav. Today he's one of the biggest Magid Shir in the world. I can't mention his name because I don't think it would be appropriate. I have to know who the person is. And Rav Yaakov saw potential as Talmidim from what? From playing handball! So there's nothing wrong with playing handball or playing basketball. And we have, we're responsible, this yeshiva, Torah Shraga, for the fact that the Hawaii basketball team is having finally Hatzlacha after so many years. His name is Gabe. And he's a very tall fellow, but he's also Yerei Shamayim, a Ben Terah. And that's really the beautiful thing, to see such a combination of items. I'll just mention one or two other matters, and this is very relevant. Sometimes in many yeshivas, there was a boy in yeshiva in Torah Das who came from a difficult background, and he had a terrible temper, constantly fighting with Talmidim. And one day, the dorm counselor, the Madrich, saw him chasing another boy with a butcher knife. Now the question. One second.
I've seen worse.
Wow. So not knowing. Wow. I don't know how much worse it can get. But not knowing whether the guy had the intention of using this butcher knife or not. So, but only to take the chance that the dorm counselor chased him. Madrid chased this boy to a first floor window, tackled him to the ground, and then they quickly gather all their troops, etc. And they arrive on the scene. So the Menahel, who came as well, he tells the young man, you know, it's unacceptable to chase people down with a butcher knife. It's not exactly appropriate behavior in yeshiva, or anywhere for that matter. And then he met with the yeshiva, and they said they have to throw him out of the yeshiva. He must leave the yeshiva miyad, because he's obviously a dangerous fellow. They decide before they're doing anything, bless Avraham Kamenetsky. So Avraham Kamenetsky, who lived in Muncie, so they had to drive Walter Muncie, and they explained to him the difficulties and the temper and the kas and all the things, and he said he has to leave the yeshiva. So Avraham Kamenetsky asked the following question. Is he a chote umachti esarabim? Does he cause other young men to sin, to do averis? Manal said no, he was not really having any detrimental effect on the other guys in yeshiva. Is he mechal shabbat vahesya? Does he publicly desecrate Shabbos? So the Manal said he's not mechal shabbat vahesya, but certainly mitzvah is mechal shabbat left and right. He doesn't observe Shabbos. So they thought that not even after what they explained to him, of course he's going to be thrown out of the yeshiva. So Rabbi Yaakov answered, what he does privately is between him and the Ribbono Shel Olam. The most important thing is that he does have a negative influence on the yeshiva as a whole. The boy clearly is in trouble and is causing you difficulty. You have to go ahead and work harder to help overcome all those difficulties, learn with him, spend time with him, schmooze with him, hang out with him, and guess what? You know how the stories end. And they live happily ever after. That this is also another true story. About Kamenetsky. He was really an astounding personality. There are many, many stories. Actually, I've prepared a few more, but one last story, perhaps I'll just end with this. One thing I will tell you, I was lucky to see Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Kamenetsky and Rav Guderman from there Yisrael together many, many times. I was always very taken by this triumvirate. You see, Avraham Kotler was also, I was never zechut to see Avraham Kotler, but they say he also was one of the triumvirate in this group. And even when they would discuss many, many issues, my Rebbe, Rav Nissim Halper, told me the one who was always machriya was Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. Because they saw him as such a chacham, such a wise person. They called him Chakim Adidai. The stipler, the father of Rav Chaim Kamenetsky, called him the wisest man among the Jewish people. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. He came to Eretz Yisrael quite often. He was very tired to sell. He has children living here, that's his grandchildren living here. And I'll just end by the following story. Once, Avraham Kamenetsky, when he was a Shiva in Brooklyn, New York, so he used to pass the Shtibel on his way to Torah Das. One day he passed the Shtibel, he saw a talus lying on the ground. There was a father who was screaming over his young son. Apparently, I guess probably there was no Arab, I imagine, at that time. I can't imagine there was an Arab in New York City, it's not Shabbos. And people used to sometimes allow their young children to carry their talisim for them on Shabbos. If I would tell you the stories about my growing up in the Bronx, I never really did. But we had a problem. For example, we lived in an area of the Bronx which was not so ay-ay-ay. That is Fort Apache. I don't know if I can describe it. It was pretty dangerous over there. That's why we had to go and acquire a few skills in order to handle the denizens. Anyway, so we became, had some expertise in karate, and we were attacked a number of times, and once or twice I was attacked by 6-7 gentlemen, if you can call them that, and so they really, I ended up in the hospital because I was pistol whipped, and they used brass knuckles on me. I lost a few teeth along the way, but I took a few with them, I just took out their kishkas, and so the, I had no choice, what can I do? Anyway, so the, many, many years ago, using whatever talents I possess, I have it in me, and my brothers less so, they're more tzaddikim, as you probably know them, but I'm not a veteran. I'm from a different world. I'm from the gangster world. Anyway, so the, so Yaakov, the young child did not want to carry on Shabbos, so he throws down the talus. He throws down his father's talus on the floor in protest, in indignation. And the father is screaming at his child for this kind of behavior. The reason why I said what I said, because we had four locks on our door. So the question is, how do you carry four keys on Shabbos? There's no Arab in the Bronx. So one key is the tie clip. One key is on your belt. What do you do with the other two? It's a massive problem. So what are you going to attach it? So people used to carry handkerchiefs. They attach it to their legs. All kinds of stuff people did. Which was on saw left and right. Means they violated Shabbos. They just didn't know. No one knew anything about Shabbos. It was not our fault. But we were makbid on the Hotzah, makbid on. My father was a Baruch Hashem, the mother, Sabbath, observing Jews. We observed the Shabbos in every sense of the word. Anyway, make a long story short. So the child throws the talus down on his father. So Rabbi Yaakov sort of sees what's going on here. He says to father, softly, how can you give techocha to your son to not want to be Mechal Shabbos? He said, my talus is ruined. It's on the floor, on the ground of New York City. I can't pick it up to brush it off. I'm helpless. So he said, Rabbi Yaakov, the following. If you're upset about your son ruining your talus, after Shabbos, you'll take him to a bezin. Take him to a din Torah. But how can you give techocha to your child for not wanting to be Mechalel the Hail of the Shabbos? Rabbi Yaakov, that was his personality. He was sweet beyond sweet. I never saw him not smile. You know, the brisket is never smile. They're always scowling. Always worried about who knows what's going to be. The only time they smile when they say a good chat, Rambam. That's when they smile. But Rabbi Yaakov was an astounding personality. He was a person of such stature, and it's kedai for you to read the biography of the Oscar. It's a beautiful biography of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. Gorgeous. I honestly and sincerely and earnestly implore you to read that biography. Rabbi Chaim, you'll enjoy it. And everyone else here as well. He also had shaitas to all the Gdol Yisrael. All of them. Chassidim, Misnagdim. He knew how to interact with all types of people. Anyway, there were three nekudas that I set up with tonight. Nekuda number one, if you remember the difference between Malach and Avoda. Nekuda number two is how, especially, Torah Jews have to be honest, impeccably honest. And Nekuda number three, about a Gadol, probably who was the model for all this kind of behavior. I'm not going to answer.